Fish number 21118, reel 10.
Cooper reel 10.
Yeah. And when I took my pockets out, I come across this watch. And I could quite understand why he said mama, mama. Because when I did it, it was a lady's watch, fob watch, adapted to a wristwatch, you know, obviously belonged to his mama. And for just a brief second, I felt rather sad about it. Then I thought to myself, well, you know, he's SS. What compassion have they got, you know? And it didn't bother me anymore. But the funny thing about it was that at night time, things got quiet, you know. Mind you, there was always masses of women around the British troops, you know. And we had strict instructions that women could go through, but not men. Can't let men through. And there was always activity. Well, it got quiet this night, and there was a bit of a... I wasn't there at the time. I had a corporal watching things. And apparently, some of the lads were missing about 1 o'clock in the morning. And what had happened was that on the Esberg Road, which was a rather wide road, there was a bit of an argument developing about horse riding. And some of the country lads felt that, you know, although the Cockneys might be a bit streetwise and up on this, when it comes to horse riding, we'll, so there was a bit of a challenge. And about 8 horses set off, and some of them missed one back at 1 o'clock in the morning. But anyway, that resolved itself. But I had an interesting experience on that border, which sticks in my mind, and it was one of the most frightening experiences I've had during the war. I was coming off one morning about 9 o'clock, and I'd finished a stint. And the officer was taking over, and I noticed him talking to a chap on a motorbike, a sidecar now. So he called me over. He said, oh, Sergeant Cooper, he said, a bit of difficulty here. He said, this chap comes from a village, he said, about 8 kilometres away. He said, and there's a train there with some Germans on it, and they've abducted a girl from the village, a girl of 15, and everybody's worried about it. And if you could go down and sort things out, be careful, he said. So I said, all right, so that's all right, you could go on a train, couple of Germans on there, no problem at all. So the bloke in the motorbike sets off, and he goes down the road, then suddenly, down the main road, the Esberg Road, he turns off the left. He keeps going, and all of a sudden he stops, and he said to me, I couldn't see it from the truck. He said, there's the train. And when I looked down, I couldn't believe my eyes. It was a train, it must have had 16 carriages on it. It was a troop train, and it oversailed the platform, which was quite lengthy. And on the platform itself, there must have been well over 1,000 Germans, rifles, and that sort of thing. So he said to me, that's a train. So I said, oh, all right. So he said, but you better come up and see, now, what was his name, Peterson. So I know Peterson was, so well, he says you better go up and see him. So went down the road a bit more, then he turned up a track. And when we got the track, at the end of the track was a farmhouse. And it was reminiscent of what you see in films of the Mackie, you know, the French resistance movement. Bikes, motorcycle, old bangers lying around the place. Anyway, I got out of the car, and he takes me in, and it must have been the resistance group in plenary session. There's this big fat, there's a big wooden table, and there's this big fat Peterson leaning over the table, and he had people sitting down the table, obviously some kind of committee. The mother of the girl who was missing was there with her husband with his hand around her crying. And Peterson said to me, you've come to get the gold back. I said, yes. Yeah, I could speak English. So he said, how many of you? So I said, 8 of us. So I said, eight's no good. Have you seen how many Germans are down there? I said, yes, I've had a look. I've seen them. So he said, you want more than eight? I said, well, we're busy. You know, there's troops coming through and, you know, that's all we can spare. So with that, he wasn't very happy about it. So I thought, so I'll bugger him, you know. So I went out, I said to the lads, right, we go down the road. We went down the road and coming down this rail station, the road we was on fairly high ground. And it had a funny arrangement where the road went round in circles until it reached the lowest point of the village where the railway station was. So we got halfway round this sort of curly arrangement of roads that was there. So I said to one of the lads, I said, right, stop the truck here. So we carried on down the road, and this circular thing, if you can understand, it sort of went down and finished up at the bottom by the station. It was only one single platform, and halfway down this circular arrangement, I stopped the truck, and I said, well, get the bling gun out and direct it onto the station. Want two blokes to come with me. Nobody was keen. So I said, now, if we get in any trouble, I said, keep your open for us. We had binoculars, you know. If we get in the trouble, I'll lift my hand up. So anyway, with that, with the two lads, I went down there. And it was almost a terrifying experience, you know, to see all these Germans armed and that. And the thing that crossed your mind, oh, to Christ, I know the war's over, you know. So walked on a platform and they all stood aside, you know, in German fashion, sort of springing aside to let me through. So I got a couple of carriages down the train and I see a chap with a stripe on him, you know, these Germans. So I said, Commandant, so, yeah, so he took me along, opened the door, and it was like one of them trains with a corridor. And on the door, in German, it must have been a German troop train, with a big K, Commandant. That this was laughable, really. So he banged on the door. So a voice came back, and he said to me, you know, sort of wait a minute. And then another voice come out again, the same voice, and I went in. And the commandant there is a short fella. And he had a woman in there, I suppose she must have been about 25 to 30. He's about 50 to 60, you know, probably on the back end of 50s. So he said, Spartans in Deutsch, I said, English? No. So he told this chap to go away and bring somebody. So anyway, two officers come there who could speak English. The commandant wants to know, what are your wishes? So I said to him, well, my battalion is on its way, but they sent me on in advance. I said, because we understand that there's a girl from the village been abducted and she's been on this train all night and she's only 15 years of age. Her parents are distraught and we want that young girl to be brought here so that we can take her back to her parents. So this commandant went crackers. The woman who was sitting there was sitting beside him and she moved the other side and she was at the back of me. And I couldn't believe this. These two officers, when I told them, he went mad, he was banging the table and all that, and he sent this, it looked like a Lance Corporal, I don't know what the rank was, sent him away to get the girl. So anyway, while I'm there, there's this woman who was really coming in, at the back of me, rubbing her leg up and down my leg. I thought myself, what the bloody hell is she up to, you know? And I thought myself, she changed hands quick enough, you know, whoever's winning the war. But anyway, they brought the girl back. And she looked as if she'd had a thoroughly enjoyable night, you know, she was laughing and, you know, joking and in a jovial mood. Only 15, but a well-built girl, you know. And anyway, I said, all right, got her onto the platform. Two lads behind me, we walked out. You know, I was glad to get out. You know, we were, all these Germans with their rifles and all that sort of thing. Anyway, I went back to the truck and got in the truck. She was in quite a jovial mood, you know, and took her back to Peterson's, to the farmhouse where Peterson was. And when we got there, the mother was standing at the door. And when she saw her mother in a distressed state, so she started crying, you know, but previous to that, she was in, looked as if she'd had an enjoyable night. So I took her in, so Peterson said to me, oh, you've got to go back. So I said, well, there she is, you know. So he said, what's going to happen to him? So I said, what do you mean, what's going to happen to him? He said, well, they're not going to get away with it, are they? So I couldn't believe this. You know, I said, you know, there must be 1,000 of them down there. I said, there's 8 of us. I said, what can we do? Well, they shouldn't be allowed to get... And with that, I thought myself, well, bugger you, and just turned around, went out and drove off. And I found that quite a frightening experience, you know. We see so many Germans on the platform, and there must have been, really, there must have been at least 1,000 of them. And I just couldn't believe that they could be so ungrateful. But with that, I think Denmark was an absolute holiday, you know, for all of us. Living on the fat of the land, being welcomed everywhere, in the Citadel, in Copenhagen, and, you know, everywhere we went, we were welcomed. And that had one unfortunate incident. We were in a town called Kolding, and we were put into an hotel there, which was disused. And we had an Irishman there, a chap named Cogan, and we had a chap named Dawson, who joined us and come all through the war. And Cogan was a bit of a flashy type of man, and he laid out about 6 or 7 pistols that he'd had in his kit bag, you know. Well, there was kids running all over the billet. We never interfere with them, you know. They like to be with the British troops and all that sort of thing. And one kid came in and picked up, of all the pistols he picked up a British Webley, you know, which is, and got a safety catch, you know. So this chap Dawson saw the kid pick it up and knew it was loaded, and he said, now put that down, son, put that down. The kid fired it. And I was away, and I wasn't there, but I was in a different billet, and someone sent over for me. And when I got there, the stretcher bearer, the corporal, had already arrived, and I went in there, and Dawson's lying there like this. So I said, these people get to know these things as much as a doctor, you know, these stretcher bearer corps. And sure enough, he died. And that gave me, for the rest of the day, one of the hardest days I've done in the army, chasing around policemen, officers, parents, all sorts, you know. I don't think I finished till about 10 o'clock at night. Anyway, it seemed such a tragedy that a lad who'd come through so much, and he was a mate of Dossett's, you know, the lad who got killed on that ridge, come through so much, should be killed in that way. Anyway, there was a burial at a big cemetery in a town called Arbenraa, and he was buried next to a large plot where they buried British airmen that had fallen out the skies or shot down over Denmark. That was our plot, and they had a sort of mass tomb there, and he was buried next to it. But then when we were in Denmark, they said that they were breaking up. They were breaking up the battalion as it stood and transferring to Rifle Brigade or other car units in Europe. And the remainder of the battalion, those that had only been there a short time, would be going home to Crowborough in Sussex, re-equip and out to the Far East. So I was exempt, but I said I wanted to stay with the battalion. So I got called into Roly Gibbs' office, and he said, "What's it about you want to stay with the battalion?" He said, "You've been out in the Middle East, Italy, and that." And he said, "Ain't you done enough?" So I said, "Well, I can't stand these Germans." I said, "They killed my brother." I said, "As a result, my mother died." I said, "And the misery they caused the family." I said, "And what they done to London." I said, "I just can't stand them." And well, he didn't call me, but then I had to see the CO, and he said the same thing. But I finished up coming home, and when we come home, we got 3 weeks on vacation leave. And while we're on vacation leave, they dropped the atom bomb. So when we reported back to Cobra after the leave, they said, "Well, we're not going to the Middle East now, the Far East now. We don't know where we're going, but we are going abroad." And we won't know until the ship is 3 miles outside of territorial waters. You know, I think that's the understanding when the company, captain opens his shield orders. And anyway, when we did get back to Cobra, they gave me another opportunity of going back to Germany. I said I didn't want it. I'd stick with the battalion wherever they went. And when we got out, we found we were going to Tripoli again. So I'd already been to Tripoli, you know, twice, knew the place inside out, so I didn't mind. And I think I was about the only one there that was involved in the capture of Tripoli. And, you know, I was treated as a sort of intelligence service, you know, for the rest of the battalion. But we took over an Italian barracks, Giana barracks there, and I'd done all sorts of things in the town until the Arab and Jew riots spread up along the African coast and become involved in Tripoli. And there we had to impose martial law and, you know, break up crowds in the streets, make sure that people weren't near the windows at night time and that sort of thing. And one of the experiences I had, I was in charge of a section, and we see a shemazel going on down some alleyway. We couldn't get in. We had to go round the block with the truck. And when we got round the block with the truck, there was a chap carrying out an old lady. She looked like a rag doll, you know. Difficult for us because she couldn't tell an Arab from the Jew. They dressed like, you know, and they've been living together in peace and harmony for centuries in this part, but of course, that spread from the east down the coast. Anyway, this old lady was dead. So someone come up and give me a rusty old cannonball. And he said something in Arabic, which I didn't understand. So I made out a report, and shortly afterwards, the officer turned up. And I said to him, you know, an old lady's been murdered. I said, as a report, I said, and I give him the report, and I said, I don't know where this come from, but somebody give me that. So I gave it to him. Well, about 3 weeks later, I'm playing a game of football in his barracks, and about four cars pulled up. And when they got out, they were colonial police. They stopped the game, you know, it was so important, they stopped the game. And
you mean English colonial police?
Oh, yeah. And he said to me, the senior officer said to me, "Are you Sergeant Cooper?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Look, we've seen your report," he said, "and we've got a person." He said, "And we think we can get a conviction." He said, "But," he said, "what we would like is the murder weapon." So it was a revelation. Now, I didn't know about the murder weapon. He said, "We understand she was bludgeoned to death with an old cannonball." So I said, "Oh, I had that. I'll go back to the officer." "Well, where is it?" So I said, "Well, I don't know." So I said, "We go round and see him." So we went round the platoon commander's office, and he's having a shower. "What is it?" He shouts, you know, when I knocked on the door. I said, "I've got the colonial police with me, sir, and they'd looking for an exhibit A for a murder, and the exhibit A is that cannonball that I gave you after the incident." Well, tell him to bugger off, that's my bloody paperweight, he said. But he opened the door and gave it to him. And we later heard that the bloke was convicted and hung.
Was the woman Arab or Jew?
Pardon?
Was the woman an Arab or a Jew?
She was Jewish. But we had several, I can remember, we had several incidents there. We had to stop people and search them. It was a surprise element. You know, there was quite a lot of deaths in Tripoli at that time as a result of this. And we were put on vantage points with traffic coming into Tripoli, particularly on market days, and they're searching them. And you'd be surprised the amount of weapons that were, you know, rusty old swords, bayonets. You know, if they didn't kill anybody as a direct consequence of stabbing them, certainly would have set up some form of blood poisoning and killed. And the roads were, there was masses of these things on the roads, you know. And there was people who were told to stop and didn't stop. And some of our lads were new at the game and were trigger happy and shot them. You know, I can remember one chap getting shot. And he had a cart full of oranges. And he was told to stop three times and he accelerated, you know, whipped the horse to get him going. And someone shot him, which I don't think was the right thing to do, you know, but he did shoot him. And the cart tipped over and the oranges went all over the road. And while we're picking him up and dealing with the situation, a young boy come up. And little Adam boy, that's my father, he said. These are mine. Wasn't worried about his father, just worried about the oranges. I put them all in the cart and drove it away. But after a while, I stopped there. And, you know, I was strictly a wartime soldier. And in those days, they were getting back to peacetime activity, you know, spit and polish and that sort of thing. And if you like, Tripoli is not a big place, it's a small place, you know. There's not much of it. It's expanded now, you know, there's been a lot of development there. But in those days, you had the high street, a few restaurants and that. We used to do patrols down the down the old city, and that was quite an experience because you had copper beaters and all the trays. People used to bring an animal down there, slaughter it on the spot, and hang all the bits and pieces on a stool, you know. And when you get down there, they'd done that 9 o'clock in the morning. By the time we got down there at 2 o'clock on patrol, it stunk to all heaven, you know. But there wasn't much of it, and they were getting back to peacetime conditions, which didn't really suit me. You know, and I can remember one day I was drilling the platoon up a road, because you can't drill them on this. There was no, in this barracks, there was no barrack square like British barracks. You know, barrack square is the centre, you know, the transition back to peacetime soldiering didn't suit me, you know. So I was drilling the parade, as I said, up the road. There was no barrack square in this Giana barracks. If you had to drill people, you had to drill them on the road. It was the only hard surface. You couldn't drill them on the sand, you know, otherwise they'd be all out of step with one another. And I was drilling them, and the second in command of the battalion came over, and while I was drilling them, and he said, Sergeant Cooper, the commanding officer is very concerned about the number of senior NCOs that are being that are leaving the army at the moment, and has given me full authority to promote you to a warrant officer class 2 on the spot if you're prepared to sign on for 9 months. But I didn't need to think about it, you know. I'd seen enough of Tripoli, and I thought to myself, well, I don't want to stop here for another 9 months. So I said no. And I came out, I think, in February 1946, and by the time my leave is expired, I had done, as a conscript, 6 years and 8 months.
How do you feel now about having served with the 60th Rifles in the Second World War?
Well, I wouldn't, you know, I know it's, it has high casualty rate, but, you know, I'm very proud of the old regiment because I've seen them perform like they did over the Sangro under very, very difficult circumstances, and they seem to have a mixture of very highly intelligent officers from Oxbridge and full of streetwise people, which makes a wonderful combination for battle, I think.
Were the soldiers streetwise?
Well, they're mostly from London.
Did the war experience leave you with any after effects?
Well, when I came home, I developed migraine, which I still get now. You know, I wonder what was happening. First thing, because you get that spectre in front of the eyes, and, you know, I wonder what it was. But the only after effects I get, other than that, was we had an experience once where, and I often think of this, in these small hamlets in Germany, you know, you get a row of houses, detached houses, close. And when you get the air raids or the battle moved into those areas, you know, we've been in several situations like this, they tend to come together in one house. And never forgetting one occasion, we're laying down by a ditch, and there was no houses this side of the road, there were fields, but the houses were the other side of the road, and we were pinned down. And our people had set the houses alight, you know, they were blazing. And we knew that in these circumstances, all the families got together in one house, because the cellars of these houses are like a suite of rooms, you know, shelves for this, shelves for that, all the produce from the farms and, you know, fruit jarred up and so to keep them through the winter and that. And this house was alight, and we knew that this particular house was being used by the people of that hamlet, and they were all down there, women and children, and we could hear squealing. And it was too much for me and a couple of the lads, and we tried to get a burst of machine gun fire, so we got back. We tried about 3 times, and in the end had to give it up. But because we were pinned down, we had to stay there. And you could hear the dying shrieks of these women and children, which altered me for about 5 or 6 years after the war. You know, when you think of people burning up, dying and shrieking, women and children, I used to wake up at night, shoot up in bed, you know, with the shrieks in my ears. But it's passed off. I haven't had it, thankfully, for donkey's years, but it did used to worry me.
Did the war experience change your attitude towards life?
Well, obviously it will do, you know, what used to seem serious situations before the war, you just simply taking your stride after the war, I think.
So what was the unit you were actually in from Normandy through to Germany? Were you in the same unit all the time?
The same unit, yeah, all throughout the war.
So it was 12 Platoon C Company?
12 Platoon C Company, 2nd Battalion, Queen Victoria, King's Royal Rifle Corps.